Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Pete Musto, Dan Friedel, Bruce Albert, and Brian Lynn. Later, Anna Mateo will bring us this week's health report. But first, here is Pete Musto.
The United States Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, says North Korea is begging for war as the UN Security Council meets on Monday to discuss North Korea's latest nuclear test. Enough is enough. War is never something the United States wants. We don't want it now. But our country's patience is not unlimited, Haley said. South Korea's defense ministry said Monday it had found signs North Korea was preparing to test another ballistic missile. The ministry also announced plans to temporarily send 4 more launchers for the THAAD missile defense system. Hours before the Security Council meeting, South Korea's military fired missiles into the Sea of Japan. It was an exercise meant to look like an attack on North Korea's nuclear test site. Over the weekend, North Korea said it tested a hydrogen bomb small enough to be carried by an intercontinental ballistic missile. The North claimed the test was a perfect success. A U.S. intelligence official said the nuclear device detonated by North Korea on Sunday was 10 times more powerful than its 5th nuclear test a year ago. We're highly confident this was a test of an advanced nuclear device, and what we've seen so far is not inconsistent with North Korea's claims, the intelligence official said. U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis repeated the warnings of President Donald Trump on Sunday. He said that North Korea can expect a massive military response if it threatens the United States, the U.S. territory of Guam, or America's allies. White House officials said the president has a range of retaliatory measures available to the U.S., including nuclear weapons. Experts reacting to Secretary Mattis's comments are hoping for diplomatic discussions instead of more tough military talk. Frank Aum is a visiting scholar at the U.S.-Korea Institute. He said the United States needs to get away from a military-centric approach to the North Korea problem set and reinvigorate diplomacy. The president, leaving a church service near the White House earlier Sunday, said only, "We'll see," when a reporter asked if he was planning to order an attack on North Korea. On Twitter, Trump said he is considering stopping all trade with any country doing business with North Korea, raising questions about what this could mean for U.S.-China commercial ties and the two countries' $650 billion in annual trade. Any U.S. call for an economic boycott of countries doing business with North Korea would focus on China because Beijing is North Korea's major ally and its trading partner. U.S. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin said he would prepare a new package of North Korea economic sanctions along these lines for consideration. "We will work with our allies. We will work with China," Mnuchin told a television interviewer on Sunday. "But people need to cut off North Korea economically. This is unacceptable behavior." I'm Pete Musto.
people who follow events in Myanmar are worried about its stability in the weeks leading up to a visit from Pope Francis. The Pope will arrive in late November. It will be the first ever visit to Myanmar by any Roman Catholic leader. The country, also known as Burma, was once a British colony, but has been independent since 1948. The majority of its people are Buddhist. For almost 70 years, Myanmar has had problems with ethnic and civil unrest. Recently, security forces have been attacking fighters from the Rohingya ethnic minority in the western state of Rakhine. The Associated Press reported Friday that almost 400 people have died in the latest violence. The government considers the Rohingya, many of whom are Muslim, illegal immigrants from Bangladesh. The Rohingya, however, say they have roots in Myanmar going back hundreds of years. Observers want to know if the Pope's trip can lead to peace. Mariano So Nying is a clergyman and a spokesman for the Catholic Bishops' Conference of Myanmar. He is helping organize the visit. He said the Pope's message will be about love and peace. I think he will try to emphasize this aspect of love, which will bring us to peace and harmony in this country, he added. Pope Francis has spoken about the Rohingya several times in recent months. More than 120,000 Rohingya are living in camps for displaced persons in the Rakhine state. Tens of thousands of Rohingya have fled to Bangladesh from western Myanmar since 2012. That was when the latest religious violence started. The situation worsened last year when a group called the Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army killed 9 people in attacks along the border. The Myanmar military launched clearance operations that some rights groups have said could be compared to crimes against humanity. Myanmar leader, State Councillor Aung San Suu Kyi, has condemned the attacks, but United Nations representatives are urging her to call for peace and a ceasefire. While some people hope the Pope's visit will start the peace process, others are concerned that he may be too focused on the troubles faced by the Rohingya. They think his message may not resonate with the majority of people in Myanmar. I'm Dan Friedel.
Rosa Parks became famous in 1955 when she refused to give up her seat on a bus to a white passenger in Montgomery, Alabama. She was important in the movement for civil rights in the American South during the 1950s and 60s. At the time, blacks in the South were forced to sit in the back of public buses, and to give up their seats to white people. Parks moved to Detroit, Michigan in 1957 to escape death threats. She continued living in Detroit until her death in 2005 at age 92. But the house in Detroit where Parks lived for many years was abandoned and scheduled to be torn down. Her niece, Rhea McCauley, bought it for $500 to stop it from being destroyed. She then gave it to American artist Ryan Mendoza. Mendoza and others took it apart and then sent it across the Atlantic Ocean to the German capital of Berlin. There, he led efforts to rebuild the house. It now is behind his own house in Berlin. It gets daily visitors, although it is difficult to find, Mendoza said. But less than a year after the house was rebuilt in Berlin, Mendoza decided it should be returned to the United States. He made the decision after deadly violence took place at a recent white nationalist event in Charlottesville, Virginia. That incident increased calls for removing statues of Confederate leaders from the Civil War in the U.S. Mendoza said there are not enough civil rights monuments to balance things out with the Confederate statues. He said the Rosa Parks house belongs back in America. Imagine if the house were on a public setting in a prominent city in the U.S., Mendoza said. That's an education tool that shouldn't be denied the American people. They have to know their past. Peter Hammer is a law professor and director of the Damon J. Keith Center for Civil Rights at Wayne State University in Detroit. He believes the house would be welcomed back in Detroit. My sense is that the Germans have adequately shamed us for not protecting our own history, Hammer told VOA. He noted that Detroit has failed to protect historical homes in the past. Such houses include the former home of Ralph Bunche, the first African-American to win the Nobel Peace Prize. He received the award in 1950 for helping negotiate peace between Israelis and Arabs that led to the creation of the Country of Israel in 1948. Bunche's home in Detroit became a parking lot. Detroit's failure to protect history also is shown by the loss of the Rosa Parks house, Hammer said. He said that Parks was an important civil rights activist long before she refused to give up her seat on a bus in Alabama. In Detroit, Hammer said, Parks served as a mentor to people fighting for equal rights. A mentor is someone who gives help and advice to people who are less experienced. I'm Bruce Alpert.
Throughout history, many leaders have used the media as an important tool to shape their image and connect with voters. Today, the use of marketing and branding is even more powerful because of the growing number of media sources and influence of social media. Former United States President Barack Obama is recognized for using marketing in new ways to get elected. He was largely unknown to many Americans before deciding to seek the presidency. Much of Obama's success came from his use of social media to reach out to the public and engage with supporters. Online social networks were still new for most people leading up to the 2008 presidential campaign. One of his most memorable tools was the Hope image created by artist Shepard Fairey, which Obama used to define his idea of leadership. This widely seen image became a big part of his campaign messaging. Advertising Age magazine even named Obama Marketer of the Year in October 2008, right before his election win over John McCain. It was the first time a politician had received the award. Marketing experts have also praised Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau for his ability to create memorable moments through social media and surprise appearances. Many photographs and videos of these events have gone viral on the internet. Becoming prime minister at age 43, some media reported on Justin Trudeau's good looks and warm, friendly personality. During the political campaign and while in office, Trudeau has shown up unannounced at cities and towns across the country to meet face-to-face with Canadians. He is often surrounded by excited crowds when he travels overseas. One of Trudeau's most memorable moments came in December 2015, when he went to an airport in Toronto to welcome the first Syrian refugees to Canada. He spoke with arriving families, offered them warm clothing, and said he was pleased to show the world how to open our hearts to the refugees. Salah Hassan is a professor of marketing at the George Washington University School of Business in Washington, D.C. He says leaders like Trudeau are good at finding new ways to connect with the public as well as showing sensitivity.
The sensitivity score with the prime ministers of Canada is very high. People adore him for his sensitivity and sensibility. So these are very important aspects.
Historically, Hassan noted, there have been other leaders who were very successful at shaping a strong personal brand.
Two world leaders come to mind who become legends in their own way, and these are Nelson Mandela, the former president of South Africa, and Anwar Sadat, the former president of Egypt.
He noted the two men were similar in a number of ways, and both became Nobel Peace Prize winners. They were seen as freedom fighters making great attempts to achieve peace. Each man kept talking about his ideas for peaceful, democratic change. However, Hassan says the branding of political leaders is much different than advertising for services or products. This is because with people, the branding also includes their feelings, personal values, and actions taken over time. Trust, he adds, is very important.
Truth and trust are very, very important elements of building the brand and bringing an authentic message of that brand that can be believable to your target audience.
Hassan adds that politicians must keep in mind that if they don't take control of their own brand, someone else will. Some world leaders use photographs, videos, and public events as a way to create a softer public image. One example is Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen. The 65-year-old ruler has led the country for 32 years and is preparing for a general election next July. Human rights groups have criticized his government for using its control over the judicial system to frighten his political opponents and activists. In a 2016 report, the U.S. State Department identified major human rights problems in Cambodia. Recently, the Cambodian leader has been using social media to show more of his personal life, along with official activities. A favorite place to leave photos is Facebook, where people can see Hun Sen shopping, Hun Sen working out, Hun Sen with family. One photo shows him smiling while driving a passenger car instead of riding in his bulletproof government vehicle. In another picture, he is seen surrounded by family members while recovering in a hospital bed. Other photos on his Facebook page show Hun Sen holding babies or meeting with young people. Similar photos can be seen on the Facebook page of Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. His government has also been accused of human rights abuses and attempts to limit political freedoms. Pictures of Erdogan engaging with children are mixed in with others showing him in the middle of large flag-waving crowds, giving speeches, and meeting world leaders. Another leader who has appeared with children at public events is North Korea's Kim Jong-un. He has faced international condemnation for his government's continued missile tests and nuclear activities. Hassan notes that leaders trying to improve a bad image face a big problem if they have not already created a lasting brand to carry them through. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Something happens to many children when they are out of school over the summer months. It is called the summer slide. This may sound like a ride at a water park, but it's not. Summer slide is when children forget much of what they learned during the latest school year. To fight the effects of summer slide, teachers often give students homework over the summer. Many parents may send children to camp or find other activities to keep them learning. As the new school year begins, most children are soon very busy with new classes and school-related activities. However, experts say keeping children busy all the time is not good for them. What should parents do instead? Nothing. Helping children succeed is one of the issues Lee Waters has been researching for over 20 years. Waters is a psychologist, an expert on human behavior. Waters says slowing down actually helps children become the best they can be.
It's a little bit like if you have too many programs running on your computer starts to slow down. And when you shut down those programs, your computer speeds up again. It's very much like that for a child's brain.
Machines need to be reset while kids need to goof off.
What I mean by goofing off is really allowing kids to have some downtime where they're not focused on a specific task, something that they choose to do, like shooting baskets or, you know, doing a creative project, cooking. It's a project that they're interested in doing that they can do more automatically and they get enjoyment from.
She adds that goofing off does not mean the brain isn't working.
It goes into this default network mode and it uses that time to process all of the information it's had during the day, to integrate new information. It makes a kind of decision about what information do I keep and put into my memory, what information do I not need and I get rid of. It's also an essential network for helping us to develop emotional intelligence, to consolidate our memory, to develop a sense of identity.
In her book, The Strength Switch, Waters suggests that parents work on building up their child's strengths instead of trying to fix their weaknesses.
In working with parents all around the world on this strength-based parenting approach, one of the common questions that I get asked is, okay, so once I've identified the strengths in my children, what do I need to do to build up those strengths? And in that question, there's often a kind of misconception that as a parent, the way that we build up our children's strengths is to get them into extra tutoring, get them into kind of every class possible.
Parents often mean well by wanting to keep their child busy, but the result is often a tired child with an overcrowded schedule. This keeps a child's brain active, learning, gathering information, and preparing for the next event. And this may have the opposite effect the parents are hoping for.
Yes, practice builds up strength, but so does downtime. One of the counterintuitives that we're finding in the field of neuroscience is that if you're constantly on task, if you're constantly practicing, in the end, it doesn't help to build up a skill or a strength as effectively as you might think.
Waters based her ideas largely on her own research in psychology, parenting, and education at the University of Melbourne in Australia. But her book also describes studies by several American researchers.
I love Mary Helen Amorto-Yang's research. She's a professor of education, psychology, and neuroscience at the University of Southern California. And she's done a lot of work on the idea that our brains have these two alternative systems.
Those two systems, or modes, she noted, are known as on-task focus and free-form attention. Mary Helen Imordo-Yang says the on-task focus is about observing and understanding one's environment. That happens, for example, when you play sports. But the other mode is activated when you are resting. Here is Imordo-Yang.
You need to be watching other people on your team and running fast and coordinating your motions and reacting to the things that you're perceiving. And then there is another network that's extremely important for being able to make meaning out of what you're doing. And that network seems to be deactivated when people are, you know, sort of playing sports and attending to the outside. And it's activated when you're resting and just daydreaming, when you're thinking about your memories and imagining things that don't actually exist here and now. You need those two modes of attention in order to function as a person in the world.
Lee Waters says she hopes parents will accept the fact that children don't have to be busy all the time. Children and adults need time to goof off now and then. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Anna Mateo.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.